football on Off the Ball.
So he brought Max Damon on, who's not 16 until December, by the way. It's sort of ridiculous. I can't really explain it, to see a 15-year-old come on and do what he did.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Welcome along to Monday night's football show. So Arsenal edge out Manchester United at Old Trafford. Liverpool survive a scare against Bournemouth. Manchester City look like they could be absolutely amazing again. And it was a very difficult start to life as Brentford manager for Keith Andrews. Delighted to say that Gavin Cooney of the42.ie is with us on the line. Gavin, how are you keeping?
Very well, Owen. How are you?
All good. So what is the most knee-jerk reaction you have from the weekend? Which way too early conclusions have you already drawn?
City to win it.
Yeah.
Arsenal to be disappointed again because they look a little bit too much like last season. And Brentford to just about stay up. I'm saying that through green-tinted glasses.
Okay, well, there's loads of interesting bits there. On the Manchester City point that you make, it kind of feels, if we're going to go for knee-jerk reactions after week one, it already feels, geez, why didn't more people predict Manchester City? I predicted Liverpool would win the Premier League last week when we did our predictions. And after looking at, you know, 9 out of the 10 games played already at this stage, I'm kind of like, why didn't I tip Manchester City? This was just so obvious all along.
I think if you want to be very reductive and very knee-jerky at the end of the first weekend of games, you can say Liverpool have an excellent attack but lack balance, that Arsenal have excellent balance but don't have an excellent attack, whereas Manchester City probably have both. Now look, caveated that they were only playing Wolves, but I was anticipating a slow start to the season from Manchester City for a number of reasons. First one obviously being their participation in the Club World Cup. They didn't go to the final. They went home about 10 days earlier than Chelsea, but they were still significantly later in starting their pre-season than Wolves and than almost all of the other Premier League teams we saw at the weekend. They're obviously without Rodri. They're obviously bedding in some new players, including Reinders and Ait Nouri from the team that started against Wolves. And they've also massively changed the staff around Pep Guardiola. So while Guardiola's there, his new assistant now is Pep Linders, who was Jurgen Klopp's assistant for years at Liverpool. And Kolo Touré is there on the sideline as well. And City looks so sharp and so energetic. One of their issues last season was that their legs fell off, having kept that team together for too long in pursuit of 4 straight league titles. There's a reason it had never been done before. And it caught up with them last season, the tipping point obviously being Rodri's injury. But even in Rodri's absence on Saturday evening, they looked so energetic. They looked like they could press again. Obviously, that's down to the infusion of new and younger legs in the team. But Bernardo Silva looked totally reinvigorated. They also looked, their level of kind of defensive cohesion was really impressive as well. You could see the influence of Linders pretty early, I thought, by how much they looked like Liverpool looked at times under Jurgen Klopp. That offside line was so high, but so effective. Wolves obviously had one goal ruled out for offside. Loads of other instances where they were done by that offside trap from the Manchester City defence early on. So the fact that they looked that energetic and that cohesive kind of took me aback. Obviously, Erling Haaland got his goals, and Tijani Reinders had the standout individual performance of the season. Like, we will see, one of the questions is how they'll move on from Kevin De Bruyne. I think probably the De Bruyne regen or replacement is probably Cherki, who came off the bench and obviously took his goal really well. Reinders looks more like the replacement for Ilkay Gundogan, who's a better Gundogan replacement than the last one that they tried, which was obviously Gundogan himself last season. Reinders had a phenomenal introduction. Maybe one of the signings of the season if he continues in that vein of form, but was certainly the standout individual performer across any game in the opening weekend.
It was one of the great Premier League debuts, you'd have to say, in recent times, Reinders. When Manchester City were at their peak, it often felt there was a casual nature to how good they were in the transfer market. And it was down to forward planning, signing a couple of years ahead or having the transfers from, you know, 2-3 years down the line planned in advance and following that blueprint. It kind of feels Cherki and Reinders kind of fit that mold. There wasn't a whole pile of fanfare about it, not a whole pile of other clubs who felt like they were in the mix for these players. It was just Manchester City coldly analysing the best players available and just making the deals happen. And I know there's been a lot of change this calendar year for Manchester City, but that could be one of the things that City fans look at and say, we are back.
Yeah, because while they barely missed with their recruitment for years and years, you think back to that summer of, was it 2016, where they had that ludicrously successful summer where they signed, they may have signed Walker that summer, but they signed Bernardo, they signed Ederson, you know, in a single transfer window, basically backbone that side and won, what was it, 6 league titles, and obviously kept them around for a little bit too late. I thought the kind of the success rate of the recruitment had dropped off a bit in a couple of recent seasons, like especially in midfield. Kovacic has proved to be a good signing, but otherwise, you know, Calvin Phillips, like a total bust. We saw Nico Gonzalez, you know, brought out of cold storage for the Wolves game, and he was fine, but like, you know, he's not proved to be Rodri's deputy or Rodri's replacement because he hardly played after arriving in the back half of last season. So particularly in midfield, they'd begun to make a few kind of recruitment errors. So obviously there's been change. We talked about the change around Guardiola on the bench. Oh, and there's been change upstairs as well, with Chiqui Begiristain has now left, and Hugo Viana has come in. He may have been Sporting off the top of my head. He was definitely in Portugal. He's the sporting director now. And the early signs of his work is that Manchester City may be back to the best of the recruitment. And, you know, they walked away from Florian Wirtz, whether it was a case of Wirtz breaking up with them or them breaking up with Wirtz. I think you'll get two different stories depending on who you talk to. But, you know, the City, better than anyone, have shopped in that kind of loosely call it maybe £45 to £70 million bracket for players, better than anyone else in the last 10 years. Obviously, it takes a lot of money to be able to do that. And while they dropped the GDP of a small country to perform some remedial action to the squad in January with mixed success, again, we're so early in the season. Like, there's an element of knee-jerk to everything that we're talking about here. But based off the 90 minutes of evidence we have from the weekend, it's been a good summer off the pitch for City in that respect.
The Linders thing is fascinating. Like, is this an admission or maybe even a change of tact from Pep Guardiola in terms of how he's thinking about football, or how he would like to be influenced by thinkers within the game? Are we going to see a new, fresh version of a Pep team this year?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that people get wrong about Guardiola is that he's totally dogmatic and that he won't change. The reality is he's got his kind of basic principles. Like, think of it as almost like the grammar of how he sees football, but he changes the vocabulary all the time. I mean, he's almost tortured by the thought of complacency, by the thought of being left behind. And the genius of Guardiola really is his ability to always innovate and always kind of be ahead of the chasing pack, which in a tournament or in a competition or a landscape like the Premier League, where there's now so much money and so much expertise, it's becoming harder and harder to do. So, you know, among the first people to think of inverting fullbacks into midfield was Guardiola. Among the first people to play false nines, even before that, prior to his time in Manchester City, was obviously Guardiola. Among the first people to think that rather than an inverted fullback into midfield, now that everyone else is doing that, let's push John Stones from centre-back into midfield. He has a shorter distance to travel, and it helped him to win the treble. Rather than play a false nine like everyone is doing now, let's get this giant Norwegian goal machine and just tell him you're going to stand in the six-yard box and you're going to turn in the pullbacks that I designed through the careful choreography of my play. So he's always managed to keep a step ahead, because you can see how tortured he is. Like, you know, it doesn't make sense that this guy, you know, always seems quite insecure and can appear slightly tortured at times. But this is a kind of a banal and cliche thing to say, but that's, you know, that self-doubt or insecurity is what makes him great. So this is the latest in that. You know, he talked last season in an interview with, I can't remember where it was, maybe it was on Sky, where he did openly wonder about being left behind, and said the football of the future now is being played by Liverpool, it's being played by Bournemouth, it's being played by these teams. And reading John McKenzie of The Athletic, who's a really kind of brilliant tactical voice on the game, was making the point that, you know, whereas Manchester City and their pomp under Guardiola, it's a very easy thing to close your eyes and picture it. You have the other team penned back in their 6-yard box almost. Definitely no forwards further than their own 18-yard box. And they're just pinning you in, and that's where they dominate the game. Whereas teams like we saw Liverpool last season will kind of hold on to the ball in deeper areas around their own penalty area and a centre circle to allow space for the likes of Mohamed Salah and Luis Diaz to almost kind of, how do we manufacture these guys in counter-attacks and transitions when we have the ball? Well, let's play with the ball in deeper areas. And I think that's something that people like John McKenzie have noticed early on in the City reign. And obviously, you know, Guardiola was always highly complimentary of Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, and evidently in hiring Klopp's right-hand man, who in many respects had an enormous influence on Klopp. I think you're seeing that play out as well.
The change that Manchester City made to accommodate the extraordinary talents of Erling Haaland is actually a fascinating jumping-off point for a whole host of other clubs in the Premier League. You could certainly make the case that his former, you know, assistant in Mikel Arteta needs to do something similar this season, now that he's got a real number nine in the team. You'd wonder as well, do Liverpool have to do something different as well? It feels like this question is on ice until we actually see Isak join the club and we see Isak play. Ekitike not doing a bad job in that position at the moment, but they've got a bit of work to do to shift the influence and the goal scoring responsibility to a central attacker, because it's obviously come from the right hand side in their attack for so many years.
This is basically a Liverpool team in transition. Like, we only ever talk about transition in terms of a side that hasn't achieved and basically is looking for an excuse as to why they haven't achieved. And I don't think many people tipped Liverpool to win the league last season. And I think if Liverpool had finished third or fourth and then spent this money, it would kind of be a lot easier to understand in a sense. You're like, oh, sure, look, Arne Slot taking over a team that wasn't his own, did loads of upheaval off the pitch. So they were just getting a sporting director and a manager in. Let's stick with the squad and then let's just see where we are for next season and start building from there. When in reality, thanks primarily to the performances of Mohamed Salah and the coaching of Slot to allow those performances from Salah flourish in a way that we've rarely seen from an individual player in a season of the Premier League ever, they obviously ended up winning the league. So now they're not improving from a position of strength. They're totally overhauling from the position of strength. And, you know, people wonder, like, how do you move on from, as you say, Salah? What we're seeing is, like, the first stages of the keys to the attack belonged to Mohamed Salah last season. He's slowly in the process of handing them over to Florian Wirtz. So that's why Liverpool are a little bit caught now between two stools, I think. You can see, like, they're now getting countered on in ways that we didn't see last season. So it's obviously a really good interview on Sky on Friday night when Arne Slot came out to face what kind of felt like Liverpool fan TV with Jamie Carragher at times, to be honest. But it was brilliant. As to, you know, does this not worry you? And Slot was saying, no, it's just a couple of players are in the wrong positions. But in terms of the overall structure of the team, I'm not that concerned. But the reality is they've taken out a midfielder who would be more defensively minded and put in Florian Wirtz, who's more offensively minded. So naturally, Liverpool just have fewer players kind of thinking slightly more pessimistically about the game. And I think maybe it's spreading to the rest of the team. You can see the number of players that they've got caught ahead of the ball on each of those movements, each of those Bournemouth goals. So that transition is now at play at Liverpool. That's why they're obviously spending so much money. It's interesting that, you know, some clubs would have, you know, just not renewed Salah, spent all the money on Florian Wirtz and said, figure it out there. Liverpool are obviously in a pretty strong financial position where they can say, no, we can continue to pay Salah the mega bucks because he'll continue to score goals. Like, he won't score them at the rate last season, but he'll still score enough goals to at least consolidate our place in the among the Champions League places, you'd imagine. And that slow kind of transition is happening now. So that's why I also think it was a good weekend for Manchester City to see how fresh and rejuvenated they are, and to look at Liverpool, who have so much firepower that they might just roll over most of the middle classes and below in the Premier League, but just don't look like they have that balance and stability that you might need to win the league.
It's going to be very interesting to see where that balance does end up. Like, he's going to continue, you'd imagine, to play with four attackers ostensibly, compared to maybe you'd say three last season. Like, that's a big step with Wirtz, Salah, Gakpo and Isak. I'm not sure who's going to play on the left, but it seems like Gakpo might be the only candidate that Liverpool have to play that position for the whole season. Like, it is a fairly seismic shift, and I've got no doubt that Virts is going to be fantastic. But I wonder at what point does the slot think, God, I'm not sure if this balance is actually worth it, because they're probably going to continue to concede goals as the weeks go by.
If they continue playing as they are, then yes, because we saw them look obviously vulnerable to Bournemouth and vulnerable to Crystal Palace, who are not two of the best teams in the Premier League, but they are two of the better ones. In fairness, and Slot was very complimentary of Bournemouth's counter-attack attacking quality after the game, and kind of not quite seeing things as pessimistically from his side's point of view as certainly Jamie Carragher and his colleagues on Sky did. But the fact is that, you know, Liverpool weren't that vulnerable against Bournemouth on the counter last season, or against Crystal Palace on the counter last season. So things have obviously changed. And I do think they'll have to rein it in a little bit, as thrilling as it was to watch Liverpool on Friday night. Obviously, the return of Gravenberch will be important. I mean, he was a vital player for them last season, and he hasn't played either of these two games to which I refer, against Crystal Palace and on Friday night against Bournemouth. But I mean, they are, like, in terms of fullback, I mean, Kirke has real kind of headbanger qualities already. Frimpong is a right-sided attacker playing right back from what I can see. And obviously then they've kind of one less kind of defensively minded midfielder in there. And you know, like, It's just such a massive change. Like, we never see this with champions. Like, for example, Salah was amazing last season, but as he explained on the pitch after Liverpool won the title, one of the reasons he was amazing was that he had a chat with Slot, which just said, look, exempt me from defensive duties and I'll deliver for you. And he did. But like, a lot of other people had to compromise their games to allow Salah have the season he did. Szoboszlai was stood right next to him as a kind of right-sided eight in a 4-3-3. So he could do his running for him. Trent Alexander-Arnold had to stop inverting into midfield. He had to stay as a meagre right back. And that was to serve Salah. And that was, obviously, Liverpool won the league. Salah had an all-timer season. It was absolutely the right thing to do for the team. But Virts is in the team now. He's standing close to Salah. He's not going to do his running for him like Szoboszlai did. So these are all interesting problems that Arne Slot has to solve. And like, this is what he's paid the big bucks for, you know. Like, Liverpool, you know, the great strength of Jurgen Klopp was his personality, was his ability to kind of to soak his character into everything the club did and bring everything along with him. That ultimately proved to be a bit of a weakness in the end, because he understandably assumed a fairly dominant position, kind of had an outsized voice in the previous kind of committee-led things that Liverpool did, and that's how you ended up with Darwin Nunez rather than Alexander Isak up front a couple of years ago. Slot has been brought in, and the structure around him kind of reinforced in terms of sporting directors and data analysis, etc., to avoid those problems happening. But, you know, Slot by name and Slot by nature, like, he's there to slot into that structure and be given these kind of tactical issues and figure them out. He did it last season, but he's going to have to do it all over again this year.
I guess the outcome would be he would expect 11 good defenders on the pitch, almost a high energy, get up, get back, do your job, and to lose that vulnerability on the counter. And maybe there's kind of a picture here of what we would expect, or what Arne Slot would expect from a modern winger, where, as you outlined there, Mo Salah's allowance that he would not have to defend as much as other people on the pitch, that's probably not going to be the case for the Mo Salah replacement in the long term. It'll be more of a Kvaratskhelia approach to being a winger, where the player is amazing at attack and also pretty good in defence and absolutely getting up and down that pitch so much. Like, it is interesting to consider, Gav, like, who the identity of the first post-Salah right winger is going to be for Liverpool. Like, is he in the ranks right now?
Oh, I mean, recency bias alert, but maybe Semenyo. he looks pretty good. I've no idea. That's a great question. I can't imagine it being a player as prolific as Salah, because it may not need to be. I mean, Liverpool are spending a whole amount of money now for guys that will not just strengthen them this season, but in seasons into the future after Salah's contract elapses. Like, he's got 2 years left. It's hard to see him renewing again, because Liverpool are not going to pay him that kind of money that he's on now. And the riches of Saudi Arabia may finally away to that point for Salah. But like, you know, they may well have Isak at the team by that point. They already have Wirtz and Ekotike. So the goals may come from a more central area. And maybe the right winger can be a guy tasked with, you know, obviously creativity, but willing to do more defensive duties a la Saka at Arsenal, as opposed to Salah at Liverpool.
Wayne Rooney, talking about Alexander Isak on Match of the Day over the course of the weekend, flagged the idea that he's refusing to come in and train. It's going to be very difficult for him to go back into Newcastle, obviously. He talks about a trust element, that he's going about it the wrong way. And then he makes an interesting point regarding Liverpool. Also for the team who's trying to sign him, in this case it looks like Liverpool, you have to wonder, is this the sort of player you want, who's going to desert his teammates and a huge football club? It's a good opportunity, but it has to be done in the right way. Any concerns about that? I hadn't really considered that, to be fair, until when Rooney mentioned it. I just kind of thought it's standard fare for a modern footballer to agitate for a move away in this manner. Any sort of issues there from a Liverpool standpoint?
I doubt it, but purely, I'm saying I doubt it from a very cynical understanding of the world, Owen, is that I don't, what Isak's behaviour is abject and disgraceful. There's nothing surprising about it, because that's just what footballers in his position do. There's generally, unless you're Real Madrid or Barcelona, there's generally always another rung to climb on the ladder of career and financial progression. And the way of the world is that at the moment, Newcastle are below Liverpool in that pyramid. So it's natural that Isak wants to do this. I guess from Liverpool's point of view, it's just like, is Isak any more likely to do this than any other player is likely to go on strike? Probably not. That's just like the grey reality of the business that they're in. And B, and this is a very pragmatic reading of the situation, there's just so much, there are fewer clubs for whom Isak would go on strike at Liverpool to join than he would at Newcastle. Just because, you know, Liverpool have seen it before, but like Luis Suarez, desperate to get out to join, well, initially Arsenal, but they managed to convince him to stay for a year because they promised that they'd sell him to Barcelona. You know, it's just like, it wasn't exactly 11th hour being swayed by his heart so big for Liverpool. It was a case of, don't join Arsenal. You can join a better club in a year's time. That's all we need from you. So as regards Isak's like character or whatever, I doubt it's an issue for Liverpool, just in the kind of very cynical, pragmatic sense that, sure, anyone could do this. Liverpool have seen this before. Newcastle are seeing it now. Most clubs will have seen this at some point.
My knee-jerk reaction to the weekend is that this is going to be the season of Wayne Rooney. You cannot move for seeing Rooney on social media. Obviously.
So what's the story? He was on Match of the Day. I didn't see Match of the Day. So he's on Match of the Day. He seems to have a kind of a BBC podcast as well. Is that right?
It seems to be a double job. BBC have certainly pushed him, and he is very much their guy. I wasn't watching his punditry on Match of the Day. I must go back and actually check it out. But the reviews have been pretty good. I've never been, overly moved by Wayne Rooney as a pundit. But perhaps the Match of the Day format is the one for him.
Yeah, it was just this Wayne Rooney's dominance of the audiovisual pundit space owners with one of the eye for Tom Brady. Yes. And his accusations of laziness. Just like, look at all the damn platforms I'm across now, Tom. I think we all kind of love Rooney's personality. He always comes across pretty well. He should be a great pundit if that's the realm in which he wants to go into. I think we've heard a bit of him on Stick to Football, and he's always been great. He's just got that great streak of individualism that Roy Keane has, to be honest. It's no surprise that they both fell out with Alex Ferguson. Very few people have fallen out with Alex Ferguson and lived to tell the tale. Keane and Rooney are obviously kindred spirits in that regard. And if Rooney is a regular fixture on our TV screens and in our podcast rotations, then I would much prefer that than for him to be the manager of Plymouth or Birmingham or something.
Yeah, agreed. Just before we go to a break, just one other question. If you go all the way back to the Manchester City game that we started, the big caveat in terms of our way too early season reactions is that they were up against a fairly poor looking Wolves side, and that could be pretty significant when it comes to the relegation battle this year. The teams who survived last season in Wolves, in Brentford, in West Ham, probably, you have three teams who could go down there. And I think the idea that we're going to go three on the bounce with the three promoted teams going down, I think that's not going to happen. It's going to be much more exciting down there.
Hopefully more exciting than last year. Again, that's a low bar to clear. Certainly Wolves have been circling the drain for a while, and losing Cunha and Nate Nordy are massive losses for them. We'll probably get on to Brentford and talk about them in a bit more depth. And certainly West Ham look the most moribund operation in the Premier League at the moment, and have for some time. Like, Graham Potter is under big pressure there. Their signings, like their summer business, doesn't seem to have kind of been particularly impressive at all. Obviously, they've got Paquetá to come back into the squad there, but I see even Edson Álvarez being linked with a move away to Jose Mourinho's Fenerbahce today. So, you know, outside of Jared Bowen, they've just got so little going for them. And I think West Ham are, I hope, Owen, in the months and years to follow, we look back at Evan Ferguson's loan spell at West Ham and conclude that that whole miserable few months said a lot more about West Ham than it did Ferguson.
Yeah, hopefully. And we'll be talking about it, Ferguson, when the season in Italy does begin very shortly as well. So Gavin Cooney of the42.ie is with us on the line. On Old Trafford yesterday, Gavin, Manchester United 0, Arsenal 1. There was this sense of relative optimism from a Manchester United standpoint afterwards. We were chatting to Miguel Delaney a little later on, earlier in the show, about this. That optimism pretty much shared by Ruben Amorim, I think it's fair to say. He said that we proved today that we can win any game in the Premier League, especially against a great team like Arsenal, and we were the better team. I guess the one thing that flies in the face of maybe that point, Gavin, is that they did not win the game yesterday.
So, like, all the positivity and the good vibes and the praise for United's performance here is already borne out by their lowly status now. Like, every now and again we get a bracing reminder as to how United's standing in the game has been so diminished. And its latest manifestation for me was reading Richard Keys' pre-season blog, where he wrote that the Premier League needs a strong Man United. In a way that, like, that phrase would be used for Leeds or for Sunderland, or, you know, just, we need a strong team in the Northeast kind of thing, you know. That's how far we've done fall, to misquote The Wire. So I thought United were a bit better. They're more energetic, certainly. They had more aggression about their play. They spent £200 million, three and four up front. And in the case of Cooney and Mbeumo, they've deliberately targeted guys with Premier League experience. Or they both looked pretty good. They had a kind of directness about their running, high level of technical quality, especially in Mbeumo's touch. He can trap the ball from regardless of how it's pinged at him. His first touch is Velcro, so that's all good stuff. But United lost again. I think it's a 15th league defeat in 28 games for Ruben Amorim. He's averaging less than a point per game. You know, he's coming up. He's only 10 games away from having completed the equivalent of a league season, and it's relegation for him still. Obviously, the omni-shambles into which he walked in provide some level of mitigation. The 22 shots yesterday, which was kind of, I think, the fifth highest in a league game under Amorim. But again, they didn't score. And it's hard to think of how many absolutely clear-cut chances they created. Like, I mean, Raya makes a good save from Mbeumo's header in the second half. Obviously, Dorgu hits the post from range. Raya makes a really smart save down to his left from Cunha from a very narrow angle, but I'm not convinced that was going in anyway. So while things were improved, United got Arsenal on a very bad day for Arsenal, and still they couldn't score, and still they lost, which is a concern for them. And while the top of the pitch has obviously been reinforced, and when they come up against lowly opposition, they should have enough firepower to simply win the game, they have chronic issues elsewhere. I mean, you know, Ruben Amorim said he was equally happy with each of his three keepers, and I think every Man United fan would say, yeah, those three keepers are all, we share the same opinion of all three, but it ain't positive. Mm-hmm. And in midfield, like, I mean, Casemiro's still plodding around there. He was all right in the first half. But then he has to plod around in there because we saw the kind of destruction that Manuel Ugarte can wreak on Manchester United's build-up play when he came on for the last, 20-odd minutes, a guy who just kind of hopeless with the ball at his feet at that level. Like, it's bewildering, really, you know. And no surprise that Luis Enrique didn't have a home for him at Bayern Saint-Germain. Baffling again how Erik ten Hag and Man United paid so much money for him. But those sins of the past will take a lot of time to fully expunge. So I thought United were definitely better, but from a low base. And while Mbeumo was very good, you know, like, Amad Diallo is still one of their best players. He's like a really kind of bright, cameo for him off the bench. And this is where I think there are questions for Amorim still, Owen, as to, does this system really suit the best players in the squad? Does it suit Bruno Fernandes to be deeper? I don't think so. He's like, his goal scoring record and creative record last season was outstanding, and United might have been relegated without him. But he's better closer to the opposition goal because he can make more things happen. But United have constructed the team in such a way that he has to play deeper. And Mbeumo looked really good off the right, but then Diallo came on. He plays right wing back. But it can't have been a coincidence. I don't know, did you notice this? Like, how often Mbeumo cut in off the right-hand side and found Diallo making a support run almost directly into him, or vice versa? Like, there was a couple of times where they basically ran the exact same line. And like that doesn't bode well for their ability to play with each other, because if United are picking a best 11, you'd imagine that both Mbeumo and Hamad will be in it. But the early signs are that they're going to take a lot of coaching to be able to play together. And the other thing about this system is that United are really struggling for midfield players. They have one in Kobbie Mainoo, who made an outstanding impression when he was first brought into the team under Ten Hag and ended up starting some games for England at Euro 2024. And Amorim can't find a place for him. And yet he will find a place for Casemiro and Ugarte. I still think, despite the money that's been spent, United will be better because they'll score more goals this season. I still think it's hard to be too enthusiastic about the prospects of the season.
There's loads in that. The Ugarte thing is the one I want to go back to there. The consensus now at this point is that he is a good defensive midfielder. Like, I guess that's a question to you, but obviously you've outlined there why you're not exactly a Manuel Ugarte fan when he's in possession. So that presents a ginormous issue, which was obvious before the summer actually began, where Bruno Fernandes maybe can't play further forward because that's where they've signed, but he also maybe needs to play deeper because Casemiro and Ugarte are the other options in those positions. It feels that the signs were there and United haven't exactly done a whole pile to combat that issue. It seems like they've tried to assign Belhiba, and after that there's no one else on the list.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see. I know there's a couple of whispers about Adam Wharton as well. Wharton would be a great signing for them. I mean, he's a proper passing midfielder. He's fantastic. But I think Adam Wharton, if he sits around Crystal Palace for another year, he can then judge as to where Man United stands relative to his other suitors, because I would imagine that the very best teams in the game will be interested in him. He's just brilliant. They need to improve in midfield, that's obvious. But they have limited funds. I know they've found the guts of 200 million to spend on Cunha and Mbeumo and Sesko. They needed to add goals to the team. They scored 44 league goals last season. That's absolutely abysmal. Like, that's close to relegation zone level attacking output. And what the data boffins would say, and we've kind of criticised United for their cold embrace of data analytics so far, but what they would say is, like, if you've got a limited amount of money to spend, buy forwards and buy goal scorers under the very, very complex mathematical formula that it's 3 points for a win and 1 point for a draw. So you're better off gambling on winning, trying to win more games. Like, the lesson of the kind of the prime lesson 101 of data analytics in football was seen at Brentford, and where the owner, Matthew Benham, said that my job as Brentford owner was to convince the manager to attack more, because we just don't attack often enough, because managers are inherently conservative, because they're like, you know, if we lose, pressure's on me, I'll lose my job. I can understand it, but, you know, what the analytics say would, you have to attack more. People don't attack often enough. Like, really interesting, slight digression, but like, really interesting passage of the book by Ian Graham, the director of research at Liverpool. He's gone now, but he was basically, for newspaper speak, he was the laptop guru, or the chief boffin of Liverpool's glory year under Jurgen Klopp. And he looked at he asked, like, why is their home advantage? Like, why do teams play? Why is the results generally in football biased towards the home side? And he said, COVID, for all its miseries, actually gave us a massive sample size to actually compare and contrast. And he found, obviously, during COVID, the home advantage was massively diminished. I mean, to the point where there actually was barely an advantage for the home side at all. So obviously, then, what makes the difference there is the fact that there are supporters in the ground, and the supporters in the ground will generally demand attack, attack, attack. The refrain that we've heard around Old Trafford probably more often than any other ground in the country. So generally that just goes to show that teams don't attack often enough. So I would actually be quite heartened that Manchester United had a limited amount of money to spend and have spent it reinforcing their attack. But unfortunately, the squad and the team is in such rag order that they also will not get away with kind of competing for Champions League places without improving at goalkeeper and without improving in midfield. And the other question mark remains, as I kind of raised there, is as to whether this Ruben Amorim 3-4-3 dogma actually still suits the vast number of players in that squad.
In terms of their opponents yesterday, it definitely feels that Arsenal are, unlike Liverpool, not in a state of transition. They're now in a state of, we need to push on and get the job done. However, it is going to be really, really telling over the year how Mikel Arteta does accommodate the talents of Victor Gyökeres and his team, because it doesn't feel like a number nine has had a good time at Arsenal over the past couple of seasons. It's not a great team to be a number nine in. He's going to have to make a couple of alterations to get the best out of him, you'd suspect.
Yeah, I was listening to Sky's interviewer, Patrick Davison, with Arteta before the game, and he asked about Victor Gyökeres and is he the final piece. I think he might now use the phrase final piece of the jigsaw, but that's what he meant. And I really thought, if you think that, you're looking at the wrong puzzle, because Arsenal's problem last season was not that they were missing loads of chances, is that they weren't really creating them. You know, they had an XG over 38 games last year of 60, I think it was, which is 22 less than Liverpool and only the sixth highest in the Premier League altogether. So that tells you that they don't create enough chances. It's not an instance of Kai Havertz just keeps booting the ball over from 2 yards out, which occasionally happened. But Havertz's actual goal record is respectable enough for kind of the curious kind of player he is. Sorry, Owen.
All good.
So obviously they brought in Gyökeres, but he kind of wasn't an outstanding debut for him, was it? Arsenal, where Arsenal kind of compared most miserably to Liverpool last season was in regards to counter-attacks. Liverpool were brilliant on the counter and Arsenal were not. And Mikel Arteta actually, after the draw at Old Trafford last season, toward the end of the season, did lament that United offered us loads of counter opportunities and we didn't take them. Now, Gyökeres, that seems to be the kind of game in which he should thrive. And that first half was a very un-Arsenal first half. It was super end-to-end. It was super elastic. And Gyökeres kind of didn't have the impact that I thought he would have. But in fairness, that's only a small sample size. But I think that where Arsenal continue, and I'm finding this more and more bizarre the longer it goes on, is the almost neglect of the left side of that attack that continues to happen. Like Martinelli started again yesterday, did kind of almost nothing. He's kind of he came through as a very talented attacking player, but he's not reached that kind of elite attacker level that you saw. He's not even a Gakpo or a Diaz who made a big difference. I think both got to double figures in the league last season for Liverpool off the left. He's nowhere near that. Arsenal have obviously prioritised signing Gyökeres, but they haven't prioritised yet signing a top quality left-sided attacker, which I find bewildering. They've obviously spent 50 million on Madueke. We were told he's going to offer some depth for Saka, but he obviously came on off the left yesterday and played pre-season off the left. Didn't add a huge amount, admittedly, to a team in full-on defensive mode when he came on. So I think until Arsenal strengthen the left side of their attack, I really don't think that they're and bring more of a counter-attacking threat, I really don't know if they're going to make that final step, because this is what's been holding them back. And the other element to that left side, say, is that Declan Rice is now out there as the left-sided attacking midfielder, much to the delight of the English punditocracy, which says finally Rice can kind of finally become the player which he's always threatened to be, box-to-box midfielder, he can add goals to his game. Well, hang on a minute. Arsenal spent £105 million on Rice because he was an outstanding defensive midfielder, and he still is. But now they've put Zubimendi in that pivot position and push Rice further forward. Rice remains an unbelievable player when the opposition have the ball. He's still got his qualities. But is he a £105 million attacking creative midfielder? No, he's not. You spend that money, you know, add a few million quid, you get Florian Wirtz. I mean, so the left side of Arsenal's attack is still looking as kind of stodgy and defensively minded as it did last season. And until they rectify that, I struggle to see how Arsenal will vastly improve their goal-scoring output to be able to live with Liverpool and Manchester City, who each scored 4 goals in the opening weekend and look like they've got goals from every area of their team.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you'd be struggling to try and point to a single chance that Arsenal created yesterday, and I'd probably include the goal in that, given the bizarre nature of it all. When it comes to Brentford, then, you spoke earlier about Matthew Benham's very kind of basic approach to saying that attack is the way to win games. So when, again, you look at the very basic numbers of last season and you lose 39 Premier League goals between Wissa and Mbeumo, it's going to be a difficult, difficult season. Things have got worse for Brentford today. Johan Wissa has unfollowed the club on Instagram. He's changed his profile picture to black and removed all club photos from his Instagram account as he looks to agitate further to get out the door and join Newcastle United. How are they going to find the required goals to not be in a relegation dogfight, Gavin? Is Ouattara from Bournemouth really going to be that person?
Well, I'll have to wait and see on Ouattara. Mbeumo and Wissa scored 59% of Brentford's goals last season. If you were to do the equivalent for, say, Liverpool, take 59% away of their goals from last season away, you'd be taking away Luis Diaz, Cody Gakpo and Mohamed Salah. So that's to give you an insight into how reliant Brentford were on their goals. Brentford are backing Keith Andrews to step up to be the head coach. This is what they do. They back up people internally to step up. That's what's going to have to happen. Kevin Schade, the German forward, had a strong finish to last season. He started on the bench yesterday because he wasn't fully fit. He decent off the bench in the second half, but obviously they're 3-0 down. The game is very different to how it would have been had he started. So he needs to step up. Igor Thiago, who was a striker actually signed at the start of last season but missed virtually all of it through injury, scored his penalty, but looked quite a lumbering presence, I have to say. So he'll have to sharpen up. Ouattara is the Mbeumo replacement. They're obviously trying to fight to hold on to Wissa. Obviously, I think the club are now, I think their nerves can be seen in the fact that they're not willing to let this guy go easily. But generally, as we were saying with Isak to Liverpool, these things will generally happen. And they're also missing yesterday Mikael Damsgaard, the Danish attacking midfielder who was very important for them last season. Just very good at kind of dropping off, collecting the ball off the centre halves and just carrying it forward and getting Brentford up the pitch. And that's where they really struggled in the first half yesterday. Like Sepp van den Berg, again, like how Liverpool shook Brentford down 25 million for this guy, I'm kind of amazed. But, you know, shocking giveaway for the third goal. It was brilliant, brilliant pass by Anderson, brilliant finish by Chris Wood. I think that's the kind of naivety to which Keith Andrews referred to in his post-match interview. So obviously a fairly bruising introduction to, I was going to say the Premier League, but to management for Andrews. Like, that is the crazy thing about, that's how wildly unprecedented his elevation and his step up have been. You know, there'll obviously be so much attention and focus on him because that's how the media industry works. We focus on the head coaches and managers to a disproportionate sense. But this is going, honestly, if Brentford finish 17th, it will be a very, very successful season because the heart has been ripped out of that team. They're almost trying to start again. And it's an unforgiving environment in which to be starting all over again.
The only positive you could really say for Brentford yesterday is that it really could have been so much worse. Like, to come away with a 3-1 defeat is actually a good outcome given how that game played out. They could have been 4 or 5-0 down at half time, and it could have got to a disastrous level, like a historically poor result in the end. So at least there is that.
That's a very Irish style pessimism to be bringing to the most Irish club in the Premier League this season, but it is nonetheless true for sure. Yeah. They could have been worse at half time. Forest still had a couple of chances in the second half, not as many. I think they probably slackened off a bit, and Brentford were definitely better with Shad on the pitch and with Jordan Henderson on the pitch. Actually, he made a bit of an impact when he came on, so that's the encouraging thing. Forest also looked brilliant. I mean, there's so many good players in that team. And while the third goal was an awful error, punished brilliantly by the pass from Anderson, second goal is just genius from Gibbs White. You know, obviously the first goal is a set piece, which they should defend better. But yeah, Andrews spoke afterwards how he has absolute belief in his players and he just has to pick them up and go again. But and I think the fixture list is pretty tough at the opening part of the season, which is pretty difficult for him as well, Andrews. But I suppose, yeah, not getting embarrassed on the opening day was maybe was a bit of a win given the halftime scoreline.
Yeah, it's Villa at home this Saturday for Brentford for the second game in Keith Andrews' managerial reign. The other thing that we learned previewing the season with Brentford commentators, as you pointed out, they like to promote from within, but they're not as knee-jerk, to use that phrase again. They're not as knee-jerk when it comes to sacking managers. It's not something that Brentford do. So he's going to be given patience, we understand, with regards to the past behaviour of the club. Just one other thing to touch on, again, if we wanted to use and get a little bit carried away with anything that happened over the course of the weekend. Put the house on Richarlison to win Golden Boot, Gavin. This is a done deal.
Some finish for the second one.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Obviously, Dominic Golanki was obviously the preferred striking option for Ange last season, but Richarlison seems to be in Thomas Frank's higher order of preference at the start of this season. And he's really good. He has two good finishes, helped obviously by Mohamed Kudu. Set up the first. Did he set up the second? I saw a lot of football at the weekend, yep. And now I'm struggling to remember. Kudu is a brilliant signing. So if he's laying things on a plate like that for Richarlison, Richarlison should have a good season. He obviously won't always run into as generous an opponent as Burnley, who really struggled, obviously, kind of unsurprisingly. But yeah, really good start for Richarlison. I thought he might leave. I didn't expect him to be ahead of Solanke in the pecking order, but at the moment he is, and if he keeps scoring goals, he'll definitely stay that way.
Yeah, Thomas Frank could turn out to be an exceptional appointment as well at Tottenham. Listen, Gavin, great stuff this evening. Thanks a million for joining us.
Cheers, Owen.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
The John Giles era with Off the Ball has come to an emotional end.
Off the Ball wouldn't exist the way it does without the existence of John Giles.
Helped by a plethora of John's friends and family within and without football, we pay tribute to the great man in front of a selected audience.
So we are here tonight to celebrate not just the impact John has had on Off the Ball over the last 20 years or so, but really the unrivaled impact that he's had on Irish football going back 70 years.
This week in the OTB football feed, look out for the full John Giles tribute night.
If we didn't say John was the best player I've ever played with, he would tell you why he was.
Eddie, I might come to that in a minute. Yeah.
We speak to John himself about his 7 decades in football, former Leeds teammates Eddie Gray and Joe Jordan, plus tributes from Liam Brady, Brian Kerr and many more.
As you say, it's what, 20 odd?
23 years.
20 years. Well, they did well to put up with me for 20 years.
Released in 3 parts, we'll drop the first part of the John Giles tribute night on Tuesday morning. And to mark the occasion, it will be available for free for a limited time only. The John Giles tribute, only available in your OTB football feed.